future trends, deep insights, industry leaders. This is the iGaming Next podcast with your host, Pierre Lindt.
I would love to hear you tell the story of when you went to Colombia and tried to explain to the Colombians how to bring online gaming to this market.
In Armenia. Oh my God. So that was before Colombian regulation. Like I helped write it. Right? So the trick was bringing Colombian regulation. So oh my God, where you sent me. What was that? That was 2015, 2016.
I love this story. It's my favorite. Yeah. You have so many stories, but this is my
that was I was afraid. I was really afraid at the point, man.
Because that goes to show how certain markets are operating under different circumstances than others, you have to take into consideration crocodiles in.
There's two sides to that story. So let's cover them both. Colombia technically had back in 2016 a central gaming. It's not a regulator, right? A central gaming company division, however you want to do it, and it was the national lottery, okay, which had shops that you could pay the bills, you could pay your phone, you could, I think, might have used it as a postal office. And I had like 30,000 these places across Colombia. And so I'll say the one of the crocodiles first part of the story. So effectively, I get invited to help this national entity with some government ties. I am presurar something. It was a long time ago. It's 5-6 years ago. I forget the name in Spanish. So I get invited to help them bring e-commerce gambling, so iGaming, into Colombia before we even start with the regulation. Because the Colombia is split into 32 districts, which are owned by 32 families. We'll get back to that. So as we're talking to them, we're trying to figure out how it is that we can help them. I try to understand what the process is of how we actually get, you know, how gambling works. So I'm like, how do your lottery games work? So they have some national games that are the same across the 32 districts, and then they have games that are unique to those districts. Okay. And the commission that the districts receive from the, you know, physical places where those tickets are bought differ depending on which ticket you buy for which game. Now the tickets, so Colombia is, vast area of Colombia is situated in Amazon. So we're talking about how they collect the revenue and so on and so forth. And they were like, yeah, well, of course, we have Bogota. I couldn't remember the capital, man. So I was like, yeah, of course, we get this much revenue from, you know, the key cities and so on. And then about 40% of the revenue comes from the jungle. Comes from where? About 40% of the revenue comes from the jungle. What do you mean? From the villages in the jungle. Okay, I mean, we're talking about millions, like millions and millions. Okay, how are you getting millions from villages in the jungle? It's like, well, we have runners. They'll come, they'll collect the tickets, and then they will, you know, go, how do you call it? Canoe across the Amazon, go into the village, and they need to run the supplies anyway and collect the post and so on, and they will sell gaming tickets, collect the money from these villages that rarely have access to infrastructure, and then the canoe back. And, you know, we lose some tickets on the way. No joke. Then we lose some tickets on the way. I'm like, well, you know, we lose some tickets. We get some, you know, sometimes they get off with the money. There's some theft that is controlled by the family of the district. Occasionally, you know, there's crocodiles and accidents. Like a crocodile. I'm not even sure. Like the way it was so casual. It's like, yeah, part of the process is a very perilous journey through the wilderness of the jungle to go sell some lottery tickets to the villagers that live, you know, relatively disconnected from civilization. And let's push some gambling on them. Why not? Right? So we started from that. And I mean, that paradigm, for me, that just the concept of like some kid just canoeing through the Amazon, you know, fighting off crocodiles so he could sell a couple of lottery tickets, killed me. I mean, I don't know. In my mind, it's absolute wilderness. I'm sure it's not as drastic as I made it out to be. But that conversation just simply made me stop for a second and go.
Yeah.
For the first time in my life, I had ever considered the concept of how you deliver a service to very remote parts of the world. You know, because, you know, we don't live in places where there are very remote parts.
Yeah.
So that is the first part. And that's hilarious. But then we decided, yes, we can help you. We had to help them understand how they can distribute the commissions. If they launched a central casino and sports book under a central regulation and give out licenses, how are they going to distribute the commissions to the 32 districts? Because right now, if you go and buy from this shop, then part of that money goes to the family that runs that district, which is fighting, and I'm saying Colombian fighting, with the family that runs the next district. So we had to figure out how to distribute the funds. So we set up a three-day conference in Armenia, in this like five-star resort in the middle of the jungle. Armenia, the city within Colombia, not right, Armenia,
Armenia,
the country. Yeah.
The country.
I hope it's pronounced Armenia. I mean, you write it Armenia, so I don't.
Yeah.
So we had to invite these 32 families. So for example, there's in Bogota, one family owns half of Bogota and another family owns the other half of Bogota. And they keep fighting where the tickets are coming from. Like it's turf feud, man.
Yeah,
it's proper
yeah.
turf feud.
Right.
And in fact, the guy that runs one of the Bogota areas, I think like 60 or 70% of Bogota, he says, he was giving off such a vibe of like the Netflix shows that we watch. Like, but really, like a very powerful man. I really enjoyed his company. But he came on day two, he came late,
yeah.
and everybody paid him respects. I mean, there was nobody that did not bow.
Yeah.
And he sat me down, he's like, you're the specialist, you're the, you know, I had to translate. I would be lying to you if part of me wasn't shitting myself, because now like he's going, prove yourself to me. You know, that kind of thing, you know? What's that scene from The Godfather, you know? You come to me on the day of my daughter's wedding.
I hope you had a mohawk at that time.
I did not have a mohawk. That was just before the mohawk,
actually. All right, yes.
So we had like this three-day show where we brought 32 districts, 32 families, and we translated our, you know, my curriculum of what they need to explain, how to explain the e-commerce. You know, the operations and what to expect from online and acquisition and what affiliates are, and it's a whole new universe, man. I mean, these people run kids through a jungle to sell tickets, you know, and I'm here talking about affiliate acquisition. Like, I knew I was losing the room. Like, and plus there's, let's say, 2 to 3 delegates from each district, 32 districts. So you're speaking to a room of anywhere between 60, 70 and 100 people, you know, they change and so on. This is very hard. The hardest part of that was nothing really happened. There was no situation that needed to be, you know, there was in any way dangerous. But we very, very cautiously had to rearrange how we distribute the families within this room. And we had to have, you know, some security and some organization just in case that we get two families too close together. And that was part of the logistics. And they're like, that experience was wonderful, man. It was so cool. It was very, very cool to get introduced in a world that is so foreign, that probably makes more money than, I don't know, man, some operators that have credit card penetration of 100% and so on.
Yeah.
They make it work. They make it work.
Yeah, you figure it out.
You figure it out, you know, if it's mobile payments, if it's this, if it's that, if it's GSM, if it's canoes through Amazon, they'll make it work. we helped write the regulation. I think a year later, Colombian licenses started being issued, and National Games and online casinos launched.
Yeah,
that was a very interesting. That's, so, yeah, that's a Colombian story.
I love that story, man. So Igor, you will be hosting some of your own podcasts here as well going forward.
Okay? Yeah.
Which is I'm really excited for that myself. Yeah. But what is it that you will be talking about, you think, in this podcast?
You know, I come from operations, right? So I've run operations for so long, and I loved it. You know, I love the fact that the guy that hired me ended up stealing all the money and making the company broken. I had to learn everything.
Yes.
About operations.
You have worked through the fire. I mean.
Oh yeah, totally. A gauntlet.
You run through the. What do they say? The gauntlet
of fire.
Yes.
Or yeah, I don't know. Yeah. I know it is the gauntlet. I love the fact that I had to learn everything about everything to microscopic detail. And in the process of that, I had to understand my players. Because you see, with economies of scale, there's a lot of wastage. And it just is. You make a lot of money at a slightly lower margin, but it's not surgical. I mean, there has to be a level of surgicalness to it. But ultimately, man, once you have the funding, once you achieve certain level of scaling, it's just hit the masses, man, hit the masses. And when you're in a position where the guy that hired you made you a key official, left the company with minus $500,000, half of which, or a quarter of which, was owed to players, and like $102 in the bank, there's no room to maneuver. Whatever funding we managed to get, like every penny counted.
Yeah.
So one of the core things in that experience was to understand what it is that the players want and what motivates them, right? And it was a very intricate, very, I can't say painful process. It was a very detailed process, you know, to try and learn. Literally part of the process was to understand the games. How do games work? Like, I can promise you that most of the casino managers today still can't properly tell you the binomial distribution and you know, the science of probability and the science of the RNG. Just understand the concept and understand the, you know, the commercial elements. But I really needed to find out what keeps the players playing. Why do they leave? Why do they want to withdraw? I needed to find everything. We had zero margin of error. So through the process of understanding the games and understanding why players play them, understanding why they play them in a certain way, at a certain bet size, in certain correlation of variables, I fell in love with the behavioral sciences. I fell in love with, and there's so much happening behind the scenes. It's like going in, looking at the transaction trail and understanding the mind of a player at any point in that journey, just by reading the figures. I remember telling my casino manager after a while, just seeing the transactions live. This is what, maybe 2012, 13, 14. I honestly felt like I was reading The Matrix. Like, we sat down, I was like, I can see it. I can see players playing. And you know, transactions just keep going. And I can track it. And we were joking about it, saying, man, this is, if somebody filmed this, it's the reading The Matrix, the green thing, because I can see what's happening behind the scenes, right? So, like, to give you a silly example, like, a guy would be playing at, let's say, €1, €1.50 a spin, and certain things would happen. And he would win, and his balance would go from, let's say, 200 to 300, and the spin value drops to half, right? So I know that he's a reserved player. I know that now he reached a certain amount of money that now he needs to protect. So he's risk adverse.
Right.
A different type of player with the same situation, €1, €1.50, balance goes up by 50% from 200 to 300, and you see his bet going to 3.
Right.
So you watch this, and you watch momentums and movements, and why they change a game, and why they change the product, why they try to withdraw, and you're starting to understand in-depth behavioral sciences, and then you apply bonuses and rewards to that, and it's magical. So for our podcast, that's literally what I want to talk about.
Behavioral science.
So yeah, behavioral science.
Gambling. Yeah.
I want to bring in. People that have dealt with addiction, that have studied addiction, that have studied Vegas, that have studied addiction by design, actually, Nicola Schultz. Was it Nicola Schultz? Yeah. I want to bring some guests that talk about what sounds do to us, right? There's so much to say. So right now, I'm not in operations anymore. I produce games now, right? I invested in and took a hands-on job at True Labs.
Right.
Which is an amazing... True Labs. True Labs. So it's an amazing game studio. Very small, just a handful of game titles at the moment, but incredible potential. And shifting to behind the curtains of actually producing the product got me a whole new vibe of like, okay, so let's now make things for players. Whereas before it was, let's deliver things to players. Now it's like, let's make the product for the players. So I really want to talk about casino games, because that's my, you know, that's my specialty, if you will, like casino as a product, casino vertical. I want to talk about the sounds. I want to talk about the rhythm. I want to talk about machine zone. I want to talk about bet sizes and product placements and attention spans and gamification. Yeah. Why are we in this industry? Is it entertaining? Like, are we vultures or are we entertainers? Right? Where do you draw the line? And regulation rules as well. Let's talk about what does German fucking one... Can I say fucking this? Yeah, I can do whatever I want.
It's like your organization says, what's the point of having fuck you money if you can't say fuck you?
Right? Yeah, what does one Eurobet do to a player? I don't give a shit what it does to an operator. Fine, it shuts down the market and turns it black. Okay. But what does it do to a player? A player that wants to fucking play. Like, a player that genuinely enjoys the gambling experience. I'm not talking about the derelict gambler, the degenerate gambler. I'm not talking about somebody that's ruined their life. I'm not talking about those. I'm talking about guys that I have met many times before. I really want to bring in Lucien. I want to bring in Lucien. He's a crazy gambler, semi-addict that flipped his life around. Knew land-based games inside and out because he would be crazy about gambling. I mentioned him on one of our podcasts. The guy that was winning and got angry yeah. until he lost.
Yes.
And then like the plane was leaving and then he upped his bet and he brought it back to like break even. Did it even win? Best time of my life. Yeah.
Break even.
That matter. Who now has an entire career, very successful career, teaching land-based operators how to arrange their floors for gamblers, how gamblers think, how gamblers move in land-based. So his proficiency is land-based. But yes, I want to talk about behaviors. I want to talk about what we do for players and to players and how the rules affect us. So that would be the theme of my podcast with very interesting out-of-industry, hopefully, guests.
Awesome. And on that note, like, what's your favorite behavioral psychology book or author or educator?
Fuck, psychology books.
Or behavioral science. I mean,
yeah, behavioral science books. You know, it's a cliche to say I love Jordan Peterson because he's the new one to the market.
Yeah, but we can do any of them. Like one of the favorites.
Hey, so like, I read Think and Grow Rich when, you know, I was probably 18 years old, and you know, How to Win Friends and Influence People and Getting Things Done,
right.
And you know, the classics that you get into, but a couple of books that really kind of hit home. I want to say Creatures of Habit. It's not. It's The Power of Habit, I believe. But there's a book that defined that we are on autopilot 90% of our life.
This is System 1, System 2?
No, that's your book, which I still can't... I was looking for it and I can't find the title. And it's the third time I'm going to ask you about it. It is... I believe it's about... Is The Power of Habit.
Right.
Let me check because it's worth checking. Yeah, Power of Habit. The Power of Habit.
So 90% of the time you are autopilot. Yes.
Yeah. So effectively, we create processes. Processes make our life easier. Okay. But the processes are based, rooted in brain synapse. And whereas you would think the process, the habit is smoking a cigarette, or the habit is training yourself to train, you now have a habit of kicking a bag, right. Which you've developed over the last 10,000 hours, over the last 5 years.
Right.
And you consider that to be a habit. Habits are so much more rooted than that. How you deal with confrontation is habit. How you deal with affection is habit. How your emotional responses are rooted in the brain synapse connecting that go back to your childhood that have created a habitual response to a certain external stimuli. At the very core of your being, the social unawkwardness or awkwardness, the charm that you have to switch on because you're in a certain situation. If you are in a large group of people that is purely social, you might be antisocial and withdrawn because you don't really feel like clowning yourself. But put the same number of people into a business environment that benefits you, and all of a sudden you're the most charming guy in the room because that's how you've been wired. Because something will trigger that is connected to the core net benefit. Your girlfriend will be too emotional and you can't understand emotions because your mother was like that and so on, and you will shut down versus somebody that will attack that emotion.
Right.
Right? That book opened up a world for me by explaining what synapses are, the brain connection, explaining how memories are stored, how memories are triggered. If I had to choose one behavioral book that really kind of was a pillar for many, many future understandings in my own behaviors and others, it would be the book that described what habits are and how they're formed.
Right.
And I hope I'm not misquoting, because I read it ages ago and I believe it was Power of Habit. And it's one of the founding pillars of a lot of behavioral books. Yeah. And I studied NLP for a while. NLP, Neuro-Linguistic Programming.
Yes.
So I was really into you know, trying to understand influence on people. You know, there's books called Sleight of Mouth and this. But ultimately, all of that is kind of phasal, where you pick up some here and there. But, you know, if I had to go back to one of those core changes, it's understanding how a human mind works.
Yeah. I think it's interesting because it's very difficult to make changes, like drastic changes in your life, without understanding the underlining
reasons why
behavior, reasons for certain things. Because you can't. It's difficult to just say one day that I'm gonna stop smoking, and you just like that. So people can, I guess.
I've quit smoking.
But if you understand,
yeah,
the reasons why your brain wants to reach for that cigarette,
so
right, it's easier to then detect.
There's a cliche going, I quit smoking every day. You know, I quit smoking with every cigarette.
Quitting smoking is the easiest thing in the whole world.
You can do it
10,000 times.
Yeah, exactly. but when I successfully quit smoking, I also know the reasons why I restarted. There are times of severe trauma. So before my father's death, weirdly enough, when I was seeing him on that ICU table with a woman, you know, putting pipes in him and stuff. He didn't die on that particular occasion, but it was the start of his sickness. I stepped outside because I was dizzy and I was in shock. I had not smoked for a year and the guy was having a cigarette outside, you know, and you allow yourself. You're like, you need the exit, so you will allow yourself at that moment in time because, and then it's a good question, why? Why will you allow yourself something so critically negative that you fought against as a reward mechanism or a savior mechanism from, what's the balance between extreme stress, a feeling of a trauma, and how does that create a justification mechanism for poison, right? Where's the link there? So I needed to investigate that on subsequent quitting elements and restart elements. I mean, I'm smoking again now, something like, you know, some relationship turmoil, and I go back to it. Yeah. But as I was plotting my exit strategy, I started breaking down the reasons why I pick up a cigarette. And I've realized that majority, in a major way, I don't know.
inventing words, left, right.
Just inventing, why not? Like, let's just invent words.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, very intelligent people, they know, they can understand intelligent words, but really intelligent people, they invent their own language. I like
right.
It.
Yes. I mean, Tolkien wrote Lord of the Rings, the whole three books, and The Hobbit, because he had invented Elvish,
yes,
as a language, and he was frustrated because there was no place for it. So he invented the entire world so he could put Elvish into it and it would have its own place. So yeah, I mean, if you're going to put me in that group, I'm there. So I started realizing that in a very major way, my cigarette uptake was a reward-based. So when I would be really productive, I would be really happy after a while. Mm-hmm. Ooh, now I can have a cigarette. Mm-hmm. Actually, very few times where it was stress-based. So okay. I used to have a cigarette when I have a change of scene. So going into a car, light a cigarette, because now we're going to go for a drive.
Right.
Enter into a restaurant. It's actually not connected to food as such, but it's connected to satiation. So I finished my meal, now I'm happy and content. Mm. Ooh, reward, right? Only a small percentage of it was very stress-driven. In fact, a lot of my chain smoking happened as a result of high productivity with anxiety. Mm. So there's, do you know the concept, the state of flow?
Well, I know the basics, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, the state of flow, you could call it the zone. Or
yeah, you're in the zone and, you know, you just
switched on.
Can I
read you something?
Yes, please.
I'm gonna try and find it.
In the meantime, I'll add something here as well. It's on the topic of kind of addiction and getting into these habits and routines. There was a really good analogy where if you imagine yourself looking at a ski slope, that is, it just has new powder. It's just been snowing, so it's all nice and clean.
This ski slope.
And then you have skiers that start going down this ski slope, and you see patterns going in this ski slope. And more, you'll find these patterns becoming more and more solidified in the snow, and the skiers seek themselves to the same patterns. And that's the way the brain works. Kind of.
So that's synapse.
In the synapse that create these patterns, right?
And so that's habit creation.
Yeah, you're drawn to this field. And then the argument for psychedelics, let me say, is that if you take psychedelics, that can kind of act as a reset to this slope in skiing, where you have the opportunity to rewire basically the synapse and create new habits.
Absolutely,
and
that's what a lot of people are saying. It does allow you.
Right.
First of all, because the synapse would connect for the first time, so your brain would be lit up.
So that's what there's been a study, for example, with the ayahuasca, which is one of the psychedelics that's been going back for thousands of years in South America, where
we can talk to you about that.
Someone said that there was a study where heroin addicts who tried to treat their heroin addictiveness to heroin by doing ayahuasca are treated around 80% of the time, because they have a chance to rewire their brain, reset.
Oh, absolutely. These patterns. I mean, and so I can give you a really really relatively heavy, very impactful ayahuasca story that was impactful for me. It kind of introduced me to ayahuasca in a big way. I don't want to digress too much, because I actually wanted to talk about, like we mentioned, like habits and cigarettes and so on. So for me, I realized, so in order to quit, I had to break down the trigger points, right? So I needed to understand what forms the habit. So I realized it was pleasure, I realized it was this, I realized it was that. And then I've realized that when I'm on a high productivity level, I have something called production out of anxiety.
Right.
So I don't know, I get anxious, I get very nervous, and then I run. And I go, but it's very unhealthy, actually. I feel knotted in my stomach. And I tried actively reversing that. I underlined this probably 15 years ago when I first read this book, and I had to come back to it time and time again. And I only noticed recently on the side of the page, there was a small in mark.
This one here.
Okay.
Are you seeing it? Like, I never read it.
All right, top layer, yeah.
And funny enough, what that says is your ability to generate power is directly proportional to your ability to relax. Your ability to generate power.
It's like a pendulum swing. You can only generate as much power as you can be relaxed.
Exactly. So in fact, they're saying this, the state of flow. So there's a quote in this book, and I want to read it. It reminded me because we were talking about anxiety, productivity, smoking cigarettes, and so on and so forth. And one of my goals and one of my investigations of behavioral science and behavior within was to create a more easygoing life for me. So it would include a work ethic without anxiety, right? Personally. So as I was on that journey, I came across this. Rowers have a word for this frictionless state, swing. Recall the pure joy of riding on a backyard swing. And funny enough, you said pendulum. An easy cycle of motion, the momentum coming from the swing itself. The swing carries us. We do not force it. We pump our legs to drive our arc higher, but gravity does most of the work. We are not so much swinging as we are being swung. The boat swings you. The shell wants to move fast. Speed sings in its lines in nature. Our job is simply to work with the shell, to stop holding it back with our thrashing struggles to go faster. Trying too hard sabotages the boat speed. Trying becomes striving, and striving undoes itself. Social climbers strive to be the aristocrats, but their efforts prove them no such thing. Aristocrats do not strive. They have already arrived. Swing is a state of arrival. It's beautiful, no?
That's awesome.
It's from a book called Getting Things Done. It's great. I highly recommend it.
So the way I would interpret that is essentially in life, you would you have swings. I mean, you swings in mood. You can feel very good. You can feel very bad. Mm-hmm. But you have to take the good with the bad. You cannot feel good without also being able to feel bad. That is the pendulum.
Yeah. So the way I perceive it is a state of acceptance. A state of acceptance of a task or a moment or an emotion. Once you are not thrashing against it or, how can I say it, berating yourself for being this way or that way or panicking because something needs to be done. The moment you accept the situation for what it is and you can just get on with the task, I think what it does is calm. It allows you to just move with the motion of whatever the rhythm your task or your movement is. And once you get into the rhythm will naturally speed up, right? Because you get into the zone. Mm. But in order to get into the zone, you can't panic about striving forward. You can't panic about the goal of where you need to go and worry about, you know, what you want to achieve. You have to worry about the process that you are in control with right now.
Right.
And let the achievement do itself.
Right.
Swing is a state of arrival. I just love that. I mean, I got it. It sung to me. I understood it. And when it came to breaking down my triggers for habit creation and so on, the anxiety through work, because I used to chain smoke while I'm working, that was the way to reverse it and form new habits. And in order to stop smoking while working, I actually had to change the way I was working. It's very, very interesting. It had nothing to do with cigarettes anymore. It had to do with the trigger of that.
You have reset that firing. You
know? It comes back from time to time. You know, it's two steps forward, one step back, but it's always two steps forward first. You know? So again, I accept the one step back.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Lately, I don't know. I smoke too much, and I could feel it. I could feel the urge in my discomfort in my lungs. Mm. I was like, okay, I crossed the line. And immediately you just stop. You decide to stop. You decide to like, okay, this is this is not where I want to be. And I wouldn't feel guilty about, oh my God, I smoked this packet yesterday. It's okay. I just, it makes you feel uncomfortable. So it's time to stop.
Yeah.
So I get the edge and I go, no, yeah, I don't want to.
I think also in regards to habit creation, the consistency is absolute key, right?
Absolutely. As well.
I mean, it goes hand in hand with habit formation. And, you know, we are drawn to the easiest way, to take the easiest path, the path of least resistance. That's what the brain wants to do, right? And oftentimes, the path of least resistance is to lay on the couch, right?
It's to not send the email.
But I think if you manage to go against,
take the road less traveled.
Yeah. But that in itself is a habit to not take the easy road.
Yeah.
Because in a way, like when you create habits, you kind of associate certain habits with endorphin
with choice.
Kicks and dopamine kicks as
you well. You associate them with choice.
Yeah, yeah. So some people, they get endorphin kicks from eating, right?
It's
like that's just their... And other people get their endorphin kicks from training, from working out.
Yeah.
You know? And then you're seeking yourself to that pattern.
Yeah.
And it's a self-serving spiral that can either be positive or negative.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, changing it from positive to negative is the hard thing because it's a paradox. You need discipline, right? You need extreme discipline. And if your predisposition is lack of discipline, oh my God, you're catch 22. So that was...
is it a predisposition or is it self-chosen?
Well, I mean, look, okay, so you have to allow a timeline in the spectrum. So for example, if you were like me, a child that was never disciplined, was left to his own devices, practiced self-gratification because that's what I was taught. My mother was a very busy journalist. My father was a very busy artist. I had a key to the flat at 4 years old. Got lost, I don't know how many times. So at some point in time, you know, you're always that kid that had high potential in school.
Yeah.
You know, he has high potential, but I don't know if he's going to fulfill his potential.
Right.
You know, failed class, I don't know how many times and so on. Except in studies that excited me, maths, physics and so on, logical studies. Then you would have your synapse build, would have a predisposition for instant gratification and escapism from effort. Right? Effort feels foreign to you.
Yeah. You start telling yourself a story. I think that's more the case. So if you're overweight as a child, your story is that you're the overweight person.
Yeah.
And therefore, if you don't understand that you can change that story,
exactly,
you'll always remain overweight.
Exactly. So you have to start from the fact. So for me, the clarity came from the understanding that new habits can be formed.
Right.
So all of a sudden I understood that I have a very strong synapse, which requires instant. I only do what interests me. So it's like, I cannot live like that because I find my life very difficult to live like that because I want to achieve certain things that need a grind. Right. So once I've realized that habitual behavior can be reformed, then it's almost like a game, gamifying yourself of going, okay, I have a choice to do this or have a choice to do that. In 10,000 choices, if I do 9,999 left and one right, I'm reinforcing the left.
Right.
But in the next 10,000, if I do 8-2 or, you know, 900-100, every time that I process the cycle and increase the number of choices to the right, eventually I'll reach a tipping point.
You tip the scale, yeah.
I'll tip the scale to from left to right choice,
right.
And now it becomes natural. Now it becomes second nature. And once I realized that was possible, it became a self-gamifying process, a challenge within itself. It became more fun. I can't say it's easy, man. I can't say that it's you know like a magic, but.
Because for every right decision you make, you tip the scales a slightly.
Yes, yes.
And it's a never-ending story as well.
I know,
mean,
totally.
It's not that you get to a point where okay, I have arrived.
No,
there is no finish line.
No,
it is about finding yourself on a path where you become a little bit better every day.
Absolutely, man.
So when I was younger, Igor, I for some reason, I didn't see myself as a good person. Like, I saw myself as more selfish and more self-motivated. And this
it's very interesting to state that. I saw myself as...
Yeah, that was the story I told myself. Yeah, I used to say, I'm not a good person. I'm a bad person. Yeah. And because I saw myself as selfish more than anything.
Yeah.
And then I moved to Malta and I surrounded myself around some people that were really, really good people. Like in Betsson, when I used to work there was a guy, his name was Henrik Holmgren. And he's one of those guys where when he walked into the office, everyone was like, oh, Henrik is there. That's a great guy.
Yeah, he's the light of the room.
And I saw, started looking at him, and I'm like, what a great way to live. You know, I realized this. Yeah. At some point, it's just click. Like, what a great... And so I started thinking like, how can I be like that? Like, I also want to be a good person.
I want to be like that, yeah.
And I realized that, like, you can force behaviors. Like, you can trick your mind, right?
Literally.
So like, I would do good things just to do them, to trick my mind that this is now the new habit kind of thing. And one of the things that I used to do, and I still do it, is... like when I go to like a public toilet,
yeah,
and you know, as men, men are not as
big. I want to see where this is going.
So okay. there would be like, you know, so there's like a bit pee on the ring or something, and I would always make sure to wipe it up.
How weird! I do the same thing, man. I honestly don't know if I always thought it was OCD or whichever, but like even if I don't need to sit down
or anything, I did it purposely. Just because no one is watching, it's not
for
a need.
Your sake.
It's not a selfish need for me to do something where I will get a compliment from you. You know, like this narcissistic niceness. You know, some people, they go out of their way to say how much they have donated, for example, because they just want
the recognition,
the narcissistic traits to be recognized.
Yeah,
and. So I wanted to find these small things where no one would recognize it, and I would make that into a habit, because I figured that is the most powerful way to trick my mind into actually becoming the person who would do it out of the goodness of my heart eventually.
Did you notice you got better over time?
Yeah, and so it was a massive change. And so I would do that and lots of other things, and I would recognize in the moment that, like, this is what a good person does. Right, so I would really say, okay, a good person would do this right now.
So you talked about a story we tell ourselves.
Yes.
And I agree with that a lot. I agree we narrate to ourselves a lot. So when I consider myself today, I consider myself an introspective person. I can't tell you when that. That's the thing. I can't tell you when that was a fact or when that was the story I began telling myself. Do you feel that introspective connects with you over time, or that there is a tipping scale where a few realizations would simmer under the surface, and then at some point in time you realize you're in control of your emotions, your behaviors, your traits, and your entire life's directive takes a sudden turn. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I honestly can't decide whether it was a gradual change toward a certain direction, or whether there were gradual changes until some sort of a tipping point where it all became about, okay, how do I perform in my environment and how can I do that better? And became an overwhelming goal.
Yeah. I think I'm going to take a stab at this. I think that all successful people that I know, and I don't mean successful as in have a lot of money,
but just
people who are trying to do the right thing, they all come from a fucked up past. And it's true.
No, you need trauma.
And so
wisdom through trauma. I mean, that's true.
And so I think that, you know, if I look at my family, like, we have a bit of a screwed up past.
Yeah.
And we are, I'm grown up with a brother and a sister. And we all turned out great, you know, and some people, they have a really difficult childhood and they turn out really bad.
Yeah,
they go down the same path.
Yeah,
and what it is that makes some people with screwed up past really want to change and for the better and do whatever they can out of their life. I mean, my girlfriend is the same. She comes from a very difficult past where her entire family was a bad family, let's say. Mm-hmm. There was no good influences around her whatsoever. Mm-hmm. But for some reason, she alone decided that that is not the path that she wants to take.
Yeah.
And she, you know, moved all halfway around the world, and she just become. And that is my question back to to you. Why do some people in this situation just turn out to be the best people you ever met because they have had this difficult experience? And why do others turn out to be the same as their surroundings?
So there's something to be said about nature versus nurture, but I actually don't want to go down that road at all. You know, maybe we have it within our nature to be good. Maybe it's the good gene, but I actually don't think that's so. I think that somewhere along the path of youth, when these things were forming, in the chaos of the negativity and the trauma, there you seek an exit and you seek some form of validation and peace. And within that, you will come across stories, books, comic books, certain characters that have a kind of moral compass to them one way or another. They have certain values. Whether that would be your favorite comic book character or whether that would be your... I used to love reading Winnetou. I'm an incredibly compassionate person. Incredibly compassionate person. Do I feel it's accidental that I grew up in a very chaotic family with a lot of violence and neglect? And I used to escape into Winnetou and old Shatterhand. I don't know if you know who they are. Very funny, a very interesting story. A German author has never gone to the United States in his entire life. And he wrote a series of books about an Apache chieftain and a white German man, big strong man, that arrives to the gold rush and he becomes a cowboy. And obviously the white fought the Indians, but these two were best friends in spite of all odds. I mean, I'm getting goosebumps, mate. James, they were best friends in spite of all odds. And what was an overwhelming connection between these two souls connecting was a sense of fairness and justice, and they could implement. They were strong and they were smart, and many injustices happened to the Apache tribes. Many injustices happened, and through this world, these two friends exerted justice and protected the weak. So I grew up in Belgrade, Serbia, where people used to stab you for a pair of shoes. Fast forward 10 years later, and I was the kid in school that used to go with a metal pipe and beat up bullies. You couldn't bully people. I developed an overwhelming sense of I will exert justice. Could it possibly be accidental that in the chaos of the negativity and what I felt was wrong with the world and what I was not experiencing, you escape into an element that soothes you and you adopt the character traits, certain values of these imaginary characters that you might connect to and idolize and imprint them onto you or imprint yourself onto them. And that begins begins your story of differentiation from your environment. You are not a prisoner to your environment anymore. You are a phoenix that rises up in spite of it. And that will also develop into pride of like, I will not let it. As your character develops, then I think with the development of identity, certain, let's say ego and pride will develop where you will put a position. This will not break me. I am stronger than this. And that keeps growing. I don't think we are even aware of it. So I would like to say that it is not nature. And it is not necessarily nurture. I would like to say that some people are lucky enough to have self-nurture, where they are exposed to certain values that allow them to overcome the trauma that surrounds them. That a decent stab?
Yeah.
I don't know. Have you had a hero, like you had a traumatic environment.
Yes.
Have you had a comic book or a movie or some form of escapism that you can go back to your childhood and say, yeah, I identified with that. I identified with that personality as my hero or someone I would like to be?
I didn't have anything like that I can remember. And I lived a very shallow life until I moved here to Malta, really.
But you're a very deep person. That depth can't have started happening in your 20s.
I was very average at school. I was very average in everything that I did. I did have some ambition, I guess, when I was a teenager. But it was never really that. I was growing up in a very tiny village of like 2,000 people with, you know, where you just live out, you coast through life. You just coast through it. And I never really had an idea what I wanted to do, anything like this, until I was in my 20s. Like, you know, I was... I had my poker club and we would not really do much, you know, we would just play poker and not really train much either. Kind of I was living very, very mediocre life until I was in my 20s and made this realization that I just want to be a good person.
It's very possible. I always had the belief that introspection, the seed of introspection happens much earlier.
Somewhere there was a seed.
Yeah.
But it's really hard to pinpoint. And it's really interesting. I mean, if you look at these two paths, Jordan, our good friend, Jordan Peterson, at least we are friends to him. He's not friend to us, but we are friend to him. He doesn't know it yet. But he talks about that there's two paths that you can take in life. You ask yourself the question, you know, why... Like a 3-year-old child asked the question, why shouldn't I lie? Like the parents tell the child, don't lie. And the child replies, why shouldn't I lie?
How incredible. I'll have to...
Like, it's like, why wouldn't I lie? If I lie, I get things easier. Yeah. If I lie, I get my will. Like, if I lie, it's self-serving. Like, I do better. And it's a great question by a 3-year-old. Why shouldn't I lie? It's like...
Yeah.
It doesn't seem to make sense not to lie.
Yeah.
But there's two paths that you can take in life. And if you take the path of lying and deceit, it leads to chaos.
Correct. Right?
So it doesn't serve a purpose. It leads to a dark path of chaos.
It leaves open-ended loops. We'll go into knots, yeah? But
and the second path is when you decide to live a noble life.
Yeah.
You want to have a noble purpose in your life. And a noble purpose, it doesn't have to be that you want to fucking change the world.
No.
But it can be that you want to make the people around you happy, right? That can be also. If you want to have a positive influence. And that decision to live a noble life is what leads you to not lie.
So I wouldn't even say you want to make the people around you happy, man. I wouldn't even go that deep.
You can choose the noble purpose as you want.
The noble purpose. So try and see it this way. So before I say that, how funny that was your example in my childhood. And I want to go back to reading the right books and whatnot and having heroes and moral codexes and whatnot. I refuse to lie. Up until maybe 7 or 8, I had one of the most traumatic memories of my life. Is my mother, I imagine her this big, obviously, right?
Yeah.
She used to always be late taking me to school, and I used to get embarrassed because teachers used to embarrass me and whatnot, right? And I asked her at one point in time to stop doing that. And then she explained to me the concept of a white lie. She's like, so just tell your teacher that you've done this. And I was like, no, that's lying. And she sat me down and explained to me why white lies are good and why I should lie. Yeah. So it's really twisted, right? As you've brought up the like a child asking why I should not lie, I was like, okay, like why should I lie? And I got a really good. In fact, I had to work on reversing the process. But something I want to tell you about noble versus or. You know, lie, deceit versus non-lie and deceit. I wouldn't even classify it as a choice to make yourself or anyone else happy or not. I would classify it as processing power, emotional processing power, and how much of that you have. And this is what I mean by that. If you go down the route of lies and deceit, you will carry many stories, many versions, many events, many scenarios in your soul and in your mind, which are open-ended. They never really close because you're always playing some form of a game. Mm. It's a high anxiety existence. Mm. Speaking the truth closes the loop. That's why it feels good when you finally admit to something. You don't carry it here anymore. It closes the loop. Doing something on time and having delayed gratification closes the thing in the back of your mind that you still have to do that. It closes the loop. Mm-hmm. Every time you close that loop of these, if you manage to live in existence where you do not produce loops, but as loops come along, you close them, either by saying the truth or doing the right thing or doing your homework on time or doing the job well and so on, you actually have an anxiety-free existence because there isn't much that you carry. There isn't much weight that you carry with you. And once you have an anxiety-free existence, you're a lot more open to receiving the world. And once you're open to receiving the world, you generally make the people around you happier.
Yeah.
That is very much a possible route down of, you know, why not deceit and why, yes, the hard thing. And it's the hard thing because, quite frankly, boils down to instant or delayed gratification. Because we want to get our animals don't understand the concept of delayed gratification, and we are animals. Yeah. A dog wants to fuck, he fucks. A dog wants to eat, he eats. You know, wants to sleep, he sleeps. Mm. There's no concept of, you know, I'll do this, I'll get it later. So we're constantly fighting between the human within us and the animal within us.
Mm-hmm. That's it's very very interesting. Mm. There's also an element of. As children.
By the way, this went fucking deep, this chat. Like, this has nothing to do with gaming for the last hour. Okay. It's good. I'm enjoying it.
We're going to start rounding up in a little bit here as well. But I want to also mention, like, as children, we you are born, the only thing you are is potential.
I love that.
I heard it. Yeah.
I mean, I guess I know which, but I love it. Yes.
We are the only thing we are. We are potential. We can potential to become anything.
Yeah.
Right. And that's what we are. Mm. And as we start to get older, our potential decreases.
Mm.
Right. So you start choosing a path. You start choosing a path. You start choosing what you like and what you not like, what we don't like. Mm. And this is a really important part of your life. It's important to decrease because at some point you have to choose a career, you have to choose your hobbies or what you like and who you are as a person.
Correct.
But the really interesting part is that I think it's not Freud, not Nietzsche, but Carl Jung, who says that the last half of your life is when you rediscover your child.
Yeah.
Because when you have solidified your career and your life, that is when you can start opening up your options again.
Yeah.
So it's almost like you decrease into like this, and then all of a sudden, and the purpose of happiness, like the purpose of your life, and is that the last part of your life you should rediscover your child.
I like that. I like that a lot.
I like that way of seeing.
Well, look, this was a great intro to behavioral sciences.
Yes.
Right? We talked about behaviors.
Exactly. But it does relate to gaming. It does relate to gambling highly because gambling is such a psychologically driven industry.
Absolutely.
It's pure psychology. Why do people gamble?
It's all about gratification.
Right? Yes.
It's all about gratification. There's so much to talk about when it comes to our players and why they do what they do. And I'm quite keen on even me discovering that journey through these podcasts, you know.
Absolutely.
But yeah, me and you are going to continue this over a beer, which
I think it's time to start to round off on our regard. This has been great. And there's another way you can formulate, like, what is true happiness? And true happiness can be defined as when you have one foot in reality and one foot in the unknown.
Yeah,
that is true happiness. And conversations like this is when you have one foot in either. I'm happy to have shared a nice happy moment with you today.
Me as well.
All right, thank you, buddy.
Well, there we go. Loved it, man. Loved it. Thank you for inviting me. We'll announce the first podcast. I'll see who we're going to bring into the fold.
Awesome. All right. Nice one. Good stuff, brother.
Thank you, man.